Well, hello and welcome to the Rest is History Club members special. Me, Ronald Reagan, and Dominic. Did you think that was really Reagan? Of course. It's so good, isn't it?
It was actually uncanny. It was uncanny. Have you ever heard that clip, Tom, of Reagan in, I think, 1983, doing a sound check, you know, like we sometimes do.
Yeah, and he says, I've given the orders. We're bombing Moscow.
Yeah. We start bombing in 10 minutes or whatever, and everyone laughs. And at the time, people...
Meanwhile, DEFCON control.
Yeah, his critics are very cross with him about that, but actually, I think it is quite funny. It's quite self-aware.
Yes.
Isn't it? I mean, it's
I mean, moderately funny, I suppose.
Oh, I think it's funny. I think it's properly funny.
Anyway, welcome to our bonus, That Brilliant Impersonation, prompted by the fact that you should all have three episodes on Ronald Reagan.
Yeah.
On your iPhones or whatever you're listening to.
And you'll be pleased to hear that these are all going out this week. So if you do binge, you won't have to go through a week of purgatory like some of you did last week with Christopher Columbus episodes 3 and 4. Could you see this, Tom?
Yes, I did.
There was a lot of discontent because some of them disgraced themselves by listening to all of the episodes in one go.
Eating all the sweeties in the sweetie box in one go and then being sick.
Exactly. So you should all have the three Reagan episodes. Other people who are not members of the club will get them Monday, Thursday, Monday. So that means you won't get an episode next Monday. You'll have to wait till Thursday for Thursdays, which I believe we haven't recorded yet, Tom.
No, we're doing that tomorrow. So that's, tomorrow will actually be yesterday because we're recording this on Monday. You'll be getting this on Wednesday. And we're recording that with, or will have recorded it with Peter Frankopan, whose new book, The Earth Transformed, has come out. It's been all over the press.
Yeah.
It's very good. I've just finished it. And we will be talking about climate apocalypse.
Yes.
Which will serve as a kind of curtain raiser for the episodes that will then follow, which we have now recorded all of them. And those two episodes on Atlantis.
Yeah, I'm sure Peter Frankopan's delighted to be thought of as your curtain raiser, Tom.
Yes.
So we've just done Atlantis, haven't we? That was jolly good fun. Lots of really interesting stuff there. Lots of strange characters. Plato is there. Heinrich Himmler is there. Graham Hancock is there.
Yeah.
Francis Bacon.
Yep.
Thomas More. Yeah. Oh, it's all going on.
Yeah.
So, you don't do any impersonations in that episode, unfortunately. But I do an impersonation of Graham Hancock. So,
did you? I forgot.
Well, I did that reading at the beginning of episode one. Do you remember that? Where I read in a very portentous voice.
Yes, you did. Yeah. He's got a slightly Scottish accent.
Does he?
Yes. Well, you've watched it.
I have, but I didn't really notice that. I just thought he sounded bland.
No, very kind of just faint hint of a Scottish birth.
He's very middle manager, isn't he? Do you not think?
Yes. Well, he looks it now.
Did he not look it before? What did it look like before? Like a berserker?
No, he looks slightly more like a journalist in East Africa, which is what he was.
Right.
But now he looks like an advert for a pension.
Yeah, exactly. For an Atlantean pension.
Yes. Well, not even Atlantean. I mean, you know, very much, you know, he's retired to south of Spain or something.
Within the proceeds from his best-selling books, no doubt. Yeah.
Well, probably the proceeds of his best-selling books. He's retired to a distant island and has become a James Bond villain.
Well, talking of best-selling books, people making profits from best-selling books, Tom,
yes. You
have a bestseller in the making.
Good segue.
More than one, I believe.
Well, who can say that? But I doubt it. But so two books coming out. Very, very exciting. The first of which, I actually now have the hard copy. So, Dominic, that's a children's book. So we're both very much in the children's book writing thing.
We're all about kindness to young people, aren't we, Tom? Isn't that what we're all about?
But the reason I was excited about this, and I posted some of the pictures on the Discord, is because it's not really the prose that marks this out. It's the illustrations, which are sensational.
Yeah.
So the publishers, Walker Books, have been very, very good to me and have provided this amazing illustrator. And the story is, it's the story of Gorgo, who was the daughter of Cleomenes, the king of Sparta, and the wife of Leonidas, who dies at Thermopylae. And she actually features in Herodotus. So the reason that I wanted to do this as my theme was that when we went to Greece, while I was writing Persian Fire, and the girls were very young, and I had to try and get them faintly interested in the battle tactics of the Spartans at Thermopylae and so on, I told the whole history of the Persian Wars through the prism of Gorgo, who is this eight-year-old girl who pops up in Herodotus. You know, and there aren't many eight-year-old girls in Herodotus. And so it's told through her eyes, And it's a world in which the gods are real. So Athena is looking after the Athenians, and Pan really does appear to Pheidippides, the Athenian runner on his way back from Sparta, does intervene at the Battle of Marathon. Poseidon is angered when Xerxes brands the sea and whips mm-hmm. the waters, and he raises the storm that destroys much of the Persian fleet.
So it's Clash of the Titans, basically, Tom.
Yes, it is. But it also, it draws on folk tales of both from Sparta and Athens. So the Spartan boys do turn into wolves. Mm-hmm. And I think I mentioned this before about this comment about this place called Brauron on the Attic coast, where it's a temple to Artemis. And there's this throwaway comment that Athenian girls, when they're age 10, go there in procession, and there they all turn into bears. It's right. What does that mean? But in my version, it means what it says. Yeah. They do all turn into bears. So I hope that'll be fun. It's beautifully, beautifully illustrated. And then I'm just reading through the proofs of Pax, the book that I may have mentioned last year I was writing.
I think I may have heard you mention it once or twice, Tom.
Yeah, about the heyday of the Roman Empire. So I'm halfway through that, just about to get to my account of Pompeii.
So I'll tell you who's really looking forward to Pax, who really should be looking forward to it. So I, on Friday, went to Sutton Grammar School.
It's where I did my driving test. Not in the school, but
not in school, presumably. No, yeah, that would be
running over children.
So I went there to give some Adventures in Time talks, and they had put on a brilliant project. So their head of history, who's a chap called Giles, who was a lovely man, he had got them all. Everybody in the school had to listen to a Rest Is History episode from our World Cup series. They had to choose a country, and they had to listen to the episode and write a review of it. And the people who they considered to have written the best reviews were sort of presented to me. And there was a young man who had written a review of your episode, Tom, about Diocletian.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He loved this because he said he was about 12 and he said...
A Croatian entry, wasn't it?
Yes, the man who saved the Roman Empire, it was Gordon. He said, well, I particularly enjoy this episode because I'm not as familiar with Diocletian as I am with some of the other Roman emperors. My favourites are the Antonines.
That's very impressive.
And he was telling me all about how he collected the coins from the Antonine dynasty.
A boy after my own heart.
And I said, well, Tom Holland, who you've probably heard, he's my sidekick on The Rest Is History. he, believe it or not, also writes books. He's finding like, the works and chops like that. And he's got this book coming out all about the Antonines. So this young man was very interested to hear all about this.
Great.
And the people at Sutton Grammar School, I commend them. I tell you what, I've also got another commendation, Tom. Are you aware of something called Butser Ancient Farm?
Yes.
So it's run or co-run or something by Dee, who is one of our members.
Yes, bless her.
Speak about Butser Ancient Farm. I don't know what it is.
It's a recreation of prehistoric and kind of early agricultural ways of living. And so kind of round huts and all kinds of stuff. I haven't been there for years, but I must go back. I gather from Dee that it's been considerably improved. Well, not improved because it was excellent in the first place, but enhanced.
Enhanced.
Even better.
It's even better.
It's even better.
So I promised Dee we would mention it. I didn't.
Well, and I think it's opening.
That you would use the word improved.
Well, I think it's opening at the end of April, and I promised Dee that I would give a shout out then. So we must remember to do that. So, okay. Dee, if you could send us a private message.
Oh, sorry, jump the gun. So, Pax, you happy with Pax when you're reading through the proofs?
It's great. I'm learning so much. Really enjoying it.
So here's the question to you, Tom. Ian B has a question. Here you are writing, plodding through the story of the Roman Empire. Plodding.
Not plodding.
That's the word I'd use.
Advancing. Inexorably.
You're trudging, stumbling through the history of the Roman Empire. And Ian says, is there any plan of you writing a book about the Eastern Roman Empire? So he's looked at a map of where your other books are taking place. He says they're like a sort of the outside of a bullseye, and Constantinople's in the middle. But you've never written explicitly about the Eastern Roman Empire. So what's going on there?
Well, I've written quite a lot about the Eastern Roman Empire. So In the Shadow of the Sword,
yes,
is very much about
Heraclius is in that a lot, isn't he? Yeah,
yeah. But Justinian, there's a lot about Byzantium in that. Mm-hmm. So that essentially runs from Justinian. Well, actually, Anastasius is in it, the bald-headed accountant,
yeah,
whose gleaming forehead resembles a mighty vein of silver. So he's in it, right the way up to the Arab sieges of Constantinople, and then Millennium also has quite a lot about Byzantium.
Yeah.
So I agree, it hasn't been the focus of a book, mm-hmm. but it's definitely featured.
I suppose the thing with the Eastern Roman Empire is you'd always be fighting against the shadow of John Julius Norwich's trilogy.
Well, I thought you were going to say Gibbon.
Well, Gibbon, but when people go to the British bookshop Waterstones and they go to that section, those are pretty much the standard histories, popular histories of the Byzantine Empire, aren't they? The John Julius Lord Norwich's series?
Yes, I think I may have mentioned this before, but my ambition, if I am spared to do it, is to write a whole history of the empire right the way up to the depopulation of Rome during Belisarius's attempt to reconquer Italy.
Yeah, 6th century.
And so that would include Constantine refounding Byzantium as Constantinople, okay. And there would be a lot then about the Eastern Roman Empire. So it will be coming as I plod my way on.
But Tom, what would you do in the sort of the 5th century or something where the source is much more sparse and there's not as much personal detail about the emperors?
To know, I've been mulling that over.
Yeah.
I've been mulling that over. There's actually quite a lot of sources for the Eastern Empire.
Yeah.
So Hypatia, for instance, all that kind of stuff, we could do that.
Yeah.
Famous woman.
Yeah.
Who we could perhaps cover in an
episode. Oh, right. I see what you're doing here. I see what you're doing here. Yes. Ever since we started The Rest Is History, some listeners have said, we'd love it if you did more episodes about women's history or about well-known women. And there's been a thread on the Discord, hasn't there, by Arena of the Wokarati, with a huge list of women that she thinks we should be talking about and haven't talked about.
So this was a thread that went up about a couple of hours before we did the live bonus.
Yeah.
So we didn't mention it, but we should discuss that now. And Arena's drift was that we weren't doing enough on specifically women's history.
Mm-hmm.
So, how do you plead, Dominic?
So, I've been thinking back to some of the episodes we've done. We did two on Lady Jane Grey this year.
Did Hatshepsut.
Oh, we did Hatshepsut.
Downton Abbey was quite a lot about female servants.
That was mainly about women in domestic service, wasn't it? We did Dido. We did 4 episodes on Cleopatra, I think. We did Theodora, obviously, very much a friend of the rest of history, Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
That's a little further back.
Done a couple of episodes on fashion, done childbirth, and of course, Love Island.
Well, Love Island, there were men involved in Love Island, Tom.
Yeah, but a lot of women.
This is not an issue that I'm qualified to pronounce well, on, Tom.
No, I mean, no. But I think also, I mean, that kind of actually sheds light on, I think, one of the issues around this, which is that we live in an age that absolutely emphasizes equity, that there should be kind of equality of opportunity, equality of representation.
Yeah.
And the issue with that, I think, is that over the vast sweep of history, that is not a principle that's been recognized. And more significantly, over the vast sweep of history, it's basically men who have been in positions of power. Mm-hmm. And it's the workings of power that conventionally have provided the material for history. Would you say that's fair?
Yes, it's certainly true that until the middle of the 20th century, maybe even the 1970s, the vast majority of historical work was either done on people who were powerful or was done on, as it were, the mass as a sort of amorphous blob, I suppose it's fair to say, sort of the English working class or something. But yeah, by and large, certainly narrative history has always been dominated, still is dominated by people with power, people whose actions and choices affect the lives of millions. That's not to say they can't be women, of course. I mean, often they are women, Catherine the Great or Margaret Thatcher or Elizabeth I or whoever, but they are obviously outnumbered, you know, in the annals of kings and prime ministers or whatever.
You know, as I say, we have done episodes on areas that stereotypically are associated with women. So two on fashion.
Yeah.
Both of which were very much prompted by my daughters, mm-hmm. as was our episode on Love Island, and childbirth, which was very much prompted by Sadie, my wife, who's a midwife. So
yeah,
I am interested in all those fields. But I think in general, it's harder for us. We find it harder, certainly, to do social history than, say, a biography of someone, because a biography gives you a beginning, a plot, and an end. So it fits more easily into the structure, say, of a podcast than a more amorphous question like the role of women in the Industrial Revolution, say.
Yeah, I think there's some degree of truth in that. I think when you're doing a podcast, 45 minutes to an hour, you need a structure. And so a narrative structure tends to be the simplest, doesn't it? Not always, but we often do narrative structures.
Yeah.
You're right that therefore social history topics, so let's say, I mean, even we did childbirth, for example, but we had to try and find a narrative way into that. So that I guess specialized in the 18th century, didn't she?
17th century.
Yes. So Yeah, it is harder to do the slightly more amorphous social. You sort of end up throwing a few examples at it, don't you? You sort of say, well, here's a nice little story, here's an anecdote or whatever. But I think sometimes, to me anyway, recording them, they feel a little bit more unsatisfying than the more biographical or the more concentrated narrative episodes, because then you can really feel you've done a subject justice. You take on through the story of it, whereas if there's no story, it just sometimes feels like we're waffling about a subject. We're waffling about a subject rather than telling a story. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. Well, I think also it's very clear in the listening figures that the big subjects get the most listeners.
Yeah, of course.
The kind of the big bangers. So I think Arena at one point said that we'd done more episodes on Julius Caesar than we had on women's history, which I felt was perhaps a little bit harsh. But on the topic of Julius Caesar, I mean, Julius Caesar is somebody who everybody recognizes. So if you have Julius Caesar in the title, people will listen to it. Yeah. But on top of that, I know loads about Julius Caesar. I've literally written books on Julius Caesar.
I've literally written the book on Julius Caesar.
So of course, it's going to be easier for me to do a podcast on Julius Caesar than it is on, I don't know.
Weavers in early 18th century Stockport.
Exactly. That's just the way it is. However, having said that, I would love to do something, say, on the role played by women in late Republican politics in Rome. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that is kind of too obscure for most listeners. You know, we could perhaps find a way in to do it. I mean, one way to do it might be Catullus, mm-hmm. great Roman poet, devoted to Lesbia. Who is Lesbia? She's often said to be Clodia, the wife, the sister. That's a Freudian slip. Sister, perhaps lover of her brother Clodius, who is the bete noire of Cicero, who is deeply implicated in the great power politics of the late Republic. So there are certainly ways in, and they are ways that I used when I wrote about Caesar.
Yeah, you know,
there are a lot of women in Rubicon, but it's harder to make them, I think, the entire focus of an episode.
I think if there are people who don't, about whom you don't have many details, biographical details, you can't sketch the character, then yes, it does become very difficult. I mean, there are obviously lots of women in history who we haven't. So Catherine the Great is a good example. Lucretia Borgia or somebody. I think people know that I would love to do at some stage somebody like Margaret Thatcher, who I've written about a lot. Or we could do... Oh, I don't know. I mean, we don't just want to do queens, do we?
For instance, you could do The Rise and Fall of the Housewife, couldn't you? I mean, you've written about that.
I could. I've written about that. I've written about quite a lot about it. And actually, I've sometimes thought about doing that as a topic. And then it's exactly that issue of thinking, well, it's quite a lot of work to frame it for a podcast, to make it interesting for a podcast. So it's not just a sort of slightly generic waffle. I think that's the...
slightly generic waffle is what we're all about.
Definitely what we're all about.
There was also a thread begun by Sam the Burgundian Wang and Aurelius, which I saw popped up maybe yesterday or today, and it's RIHC, so Rest History Club, bookshelf, index and categorization of all the various episodes. And they, between them, have broken down the episodes into subject matter. So economics is 3%, sport is 3%, walking tours 3%, banter 3%. Science and nature, 3%, religion, 10%, warfare, 13%, biography, royals and Harry. I think Harry is a royal, so.
Well, is he?
14%, culture, 14%, politics, 15%, general history, 20%. So,
right. And they've also done it by location and by time. So location, world history is actually the 23.4%, followed by the British Isles, 23%. I mean, sometimes people say very British centric. I mean, I'll be frank with you. I'm not giving anything away. We are both British and we're always going to be talking a lot about our own history. I mean, if that really is I can't believe that anybody would find that surprising. Europe 20%.
Well, under a quarter of our episodes are British. Yeah,
not enough. Not enough, I think.
Tom. Yeah, we should do more, shouldn't we?
And then on epochs, actually, interestingly, looking at this, only 7% of our output is early modern. Only 10% is medieval. I mean, you can see why that is, because that's the bit in between our two real enthusiasms, isn't it? So yes. Classical antiquity gets 11%. Actually, contemporary, 23%. That's quite surprising.
Well, I suppose that because I've lived through the contemporary, I can at least contribute. So maybe that's why. So yeah, so ancient histories, by which it means pre-classical, so Egyptian, Babylonian, that kind of stuff, is 2%, classical 11%, contemporary 23%, early modern 7%, late modern 14%, long sweep 23%, medieval 10%, prehistory 2%, First World War to Second World War 10%. The medieval is a big gap, and we will be beefing that up. So we've got the four episodes coming up on the Hundred Years' War. You see, I would very much like to do one on Saint Catherine of Siena.
Okay. Is that the wheel? Is that the Catherine wheel?
No. She is the one who ends up getting married to Jesus. And she uses Jesus' foreskin as her wedding ring.
You want to do it purely so you can say that again, isn't it? Isn't that right?
I do. But she's very interesting because she's a focus for all kinds of debates about eating disorders, psychological disorders in teenage girls, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Which there's quite a lot of interesting writing about that. But also she is a massively significant player in the Great Schism. So we could use it as a way into the Great Schism.
Well, that mention of the Great Schism is clearly what will persuade Jack and Tony, Tom, I think, other than the...
Yeah, well, we'll find a way of doing it.
I love the Great Schism at Restless History Towers. I see, actually, you say, oh, medieval is the big gap, but there's 33 episodes.
Actually, early modern is the big gap, isn't it?
Early modern, but I mean, that's 20... Even so, that's a big gap, but that's still 23 hours worth of material that we've recorded on it. So although we sometimes beat ourselves up, you and I never beat ourselves up. I think... I mean, at some basic level, we do what we're really enthusiastic about, don't we? I mean, that's the nature of the podcast. Yeah. If we wanted to be dictated to by a sort of commissioning team, we would be the BBC. That said, there are a couple of things that I do feel genuinely guilty about. So one of them, I mean, it pains me to use these words because they are like, they're chiseled on my soul. They are the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
Oh, yes.
We promised to do that two and a half years ago. We haven't done it. The other thing is the Great Northern War.
Do you know about these? Because you know who does is Dr. Francis Young.
Yeah, he knows about both those things.
So he does know about that. So he came on and did royalty and witchcraft and magic in Britain. But he knows all about that. So he might be
Yeah, working. I know. I think he would be. I'd love to do. I actually bought Tom last year. Because out of guilt, I bought a book about the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth that turned out to be about 9,000 pages long and much denser than I had anticipated. And a lot of it was about bishops.
Brilliant. Oh, well, let's do that then. Great.
Yeah, you'd love it.
Yeah, I love some bishops. All right, we must do that.
Let's. We haven't really put that issue to bed, but time is pressing on. So that's just how it is. Gladiators in Rome, in Britain. What's all this, Tom?
So the Cultist of Ars, which shows two gladiators fighting. I think they have shown that it was made in Britain, and therefore it's being said that it is the only evidence of gladiatorial combat in Britain, according to the head of Colchester and Ipswich Museums, which is who has responsibility for this pot. I think he's slightly bigging it up, because I think there's plenty of evidence that gladiators fought in Britain, namely the existence of amphitheatres.
God.
So I think he's slightly overdoing it. And actually, there's a cemetery, supposedly, of gladiators that were found in York a few years ago. Difficult to know if that, you know, there's no hard proof of that. But there was, as I remember, there was the bones of one of the people buried in the cemetery had the bite marks from a big cat, tiger or something.
Oh, crikey.
So maybe someone who'd been savaged by one of the beasts.
I'd love to hear you on gladiators.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, there's loads about gladiators in packs, I should say, if people are interested in that.
A friend of the Rest is History, Robert Coles, is keen to come on and talk about
the boxing match.
This extraordinary boxing match in the 19th century that all sorts of cabinet ministers trudged over fields to, like an illegal rave, because it was illegal. What was it called? Somebody against Sayer. Healy against Sayer or something like that, I can't remember.
It's an American against an Englishman.
It is.
It? Yeah.
And it's a brilliant window into Victorian England and into the sport of boxing. And I actually thought that would be a nice companion piece to gladiators.
We could do that. So there's loads about the Colosseum and gladiators in PAX.
What did Mary Beard come on to talk to us about? Classics. And gladiators came up in that.
Yeah.
If you were a time traveller, here's a question for you. If you were a time traveller and you went back to the Roman world that you've written about, and you were there for 3 days, you know, you had your sort of 3-day itinerary, would you take in a gladiatorial bout?
I have often pondered this, because whenever I read about it, I think how thrilling it must have been. So there's this incredible description by Augustine in the Confessions, where he's describing a friend of his,
Right.
Almost certainly Augustine himself, you know, he's very snooty about gladiatorial combat.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for snobbish reasons, not for moral reasons, he looks down on it, you know, rather like, I don't know, someone sneering at football or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's going past and he hears the cheers and he thinks, oh, I'll just have a pop in. And he becomes completely addicted. Can't tear himself away.
Yeah.
Great sporting occasions often have an element of peril and danger, don't they?
I suppose.
So you mentioned boxing.
Yeah, boxing.
I mean, one of the things that I loved about cricket was when there were very, very fast bowlers,
mm-hmm.
bowling at the head. The visceral quality of it was definitely a part of the excitement. So would I don't know. I mean, dare I say, my sensibilities are probably too Christian.
Yours of all people's, yeah.
I'd feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why people object to bullfighting and...
Yes, of course. Yeah, bullfighting is a good parallel. If you were in...
Bullfighting is probably the best parallel because it, in a sense, it is, you know, it stands in that line of descent and it's often done it literally in Roman amphitheatres.
Exactly. But if you were in some small town in Spain, let's say...
I wouldn't. I mean, I have been in that position and I haven't gone to see it because I feel squeamish about watching animals suffer.
Yeah.
Would you? I don't know.
No, I mean, I was thinking it's a difficult one because the animal hasn't chosen to be in that position.
Well, neither have the gladiators.
No, but that I knew there was going to be that because the gladiators, of course, are slaves.
Some of them have. Some have volunteered.
But an awful lot are slaves, aren't they? They're doing it involuntarily.
The thing I would want to watch is the way in which there are parallels with sport today.
Yeah.
The best gladiators are stars. And that there's absolutely an understanding from the people who are organizing them and funding them that the degree of jeopardy is precisely what people want.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that with gladiators, the script hasn't necessarily been written. And that's why executions are seen as people who prefer executions are despised, basically, for not having proper connoisseurship. So Claudius loved an execution,
yeah,
it is said, rather than to watch gladiators. And this marks him down.
That is pretty weird. Dickens, of course, liked to watch executions, though he often found them repellent.
Yeah.
Theo, our producer, is saying, can you offer some quick thoughts on the movie, brackets Russell Crowe?
It's brilliant. Loved it.
So Theo, I think Tom and I talked about the film when we were doing a live show at the Odeon, Leicester Square, in late 2021. We did talk about Gladiator, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
And I remember, and I think I said at the time, I remember watching it in Washington, D.C., in the cinema, and right from the beginning, feeling that I was watching it with a sort of 11-year-old version of myself.
Yeah.
And just being so pleased for that 11-year-old version that he was getting to see something that he would have dreamed, he could barely have dreamed of seeing and would have loved so much. And I did love it. I loved it.
So there are two times I've had that. The first was watching Jurassic Park.
All right.
Seeing the Brachiosaur for the first time. And the second was watching that opening battle that I think they fought in Surrey, a wood in Surrey.
Right.
But it's supposedly in Germany, Unleash Hell.
Yeah,
I loved it, but I also loved the portrayal of the Colosseum, which is, as everyone says, vastly overinflated. It wasn't that big, but a bit like the use of napalm in the opening battle scene, it gives you a sense of what Rome was like simply by being overwhelming.
Yeah,
so in a sense, the ahistorical character of it is historical, which I think is so important when you film the ancient world. That you shouldn't.
Yeah, it's why you like 300, isn't it?
You shouldn't try and get it absolutely accurate because that very kind of fetishizing of accuracy is anachronistic. If you're portraying the Colosseum and you want to be true to the spirit in which it was built, you should make it look a lot bigger than it was. And that's exactly what they do in the film.
Until Gladiator, all cinematic depictions of the Romans, I would say, I had always found very disappointing. I'd found them far too sort of prissy, as it were.
Yeah.
People standing around in robes talking about senatorial procedures or something and drinking wine. And I wanted to see...
Or Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
Who is this one you call the Christ? Right. All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, or just sort of like... See, I Claudius, which I think is brilliant, but I Claudius, people arguing about obscure relations of Augustus or something at great length. But you never get to see any of the stuff.
Any of the battles.
No.
So yes, Tiberius has come back from the front. He has slaughtered many Germans.
Yeah.
And, I'd love to see him.
Yeah, and it's actually just George Baker with a lot of makeup.
Yes.
So, no, I think we're big fans of Gladiator. Well, we'll come back to Gladiators, absolutely. Now, we have a question from Le Marquis de Montcalm. He wishes that we had talked more in the Nazi episodes about the lie that the German army was on the cusp of victory when it was stabbed in the back by the politicians. I think we did talk about that a little bit. We could have talked about it more, I suppose. And he wishes we had talked even more about the German Revolution of late 1918, 1919. Tom, do you think there's a great appetite among the fans for us to return to the territory of the Nazis?
Possibly. Rosa Luxemburg. That would.
Rosa Luxemburg is a very good subject, actually.
She's a lady. That would get us.
We can't go.
Arena would be pleased.
Yeah. I mean, it's more likely, Arena, that we'd do a podcast about Rosa Luxemburg than it is about one of your other suggestions, Barbara Castle. I mean, I've written a lot about Barbara Castle, and I can't conceive of doing a podcast about Barbara Castle. Can you, Tom? If I said to you, let's do Barbara Castle?
I think you would make it interesting. I think you have an incredible capacity to make almost anything interesting.
Oh, Tom, that's kind of you.
Well, I mean, all your book, obscure figures from the Labour Party in the late 1960s.
Yeah.
And it's all fascinating.
Well, that's kind.
I think you can make anything interesting.
I'm going to press for that podcast on the life and career of Richard Crossman. Anyway.
But it's a question of whether people, would they know that it was worth listening to?
The woman who invented seatbelts.
That was a Two Ronnies joke. It was a Two Ronnies joke. Barbara Castle was the name that after the feminist revolution gets given to the Tower of London.
Barbara Castle. Oh, very good. Well, okay, so we've almost done it.
There we go.
She put seatbelts in cars, rather like...
But Dominic, just going back to the question of Le Marquis de Montcalm.
Yeah.
I don't know, because I don't know enough about the subject to know how interesting it would be, but I suspect it would be very interesting.
I think Rosa Luxemburg would be terribly interesting.
He's saying that it's... How did so many in Germany forget the experience of the failed German Revolution, how close their country had been to fulfilling Marx's communist prediction? I mean, how close did it become to civil war?
In Munich, there is basically a civil war.
I'm very keen to go back and do that.
Okay, fine. Well, there you go. We'll do that.
So we'll do that. I see the literary smackdown following the US presidential smackdown, which was won by Lincoln.
Yeah.
Who I was rooting for.
So these are kind of votes that people do on the Discord, aren't they?
Yeah. And who have we got? We've now got a literary one. We've got Agatha Christie, Stevenson, visits Robert Louis Stevenson, Dickens, yeah. Austin, Homer, Joyce, Dostoevsky, Hemingway, Conan Doyle, Twain, Shakespeare, Orwell, Tolstoy, Steinbeck.
Steinbeck?
Tolkien and Cervantes.
What the hell is Steinbeck doing now? He's a terrible writer.
Yeah, no Virgil, no Dante.
Where's Joseph Conrad of the Daily Mail? Where's...
Kipling.
George Eliot. Where's George Eliot?
Well, Dominic, it's very easy, isn't it, to just criticise people who haven't made the cut.
Well, that's why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Flaubert. That you cannot have that list and not have Flaubert on it. Madame Bovary, surely one of the top two or three novels ever written.
No Byron.
No Byron, Tom. So surely this is Shakespeare for the win, isn't it?
Kind of the Lincoln of writers, you'd have thought.
He's going to beat Orwell in the first round. He's going to beat Conan Doyle. Next, Conan Doyle's got to beat Mark Twain. He's going to beat Cervantes or Tolstoy. Shakespeare versus Tolstoy is quite a tough one in the semis.
Well, it's a grudge match, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Because Tolstoy hated Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Despised Shakespeare.
But I would take Shakespeare surely over Tolstoy. And then Shakespeare versus Dickens, I would assume.
No, Dickens has been knocked out by Jane Austen.
I like Jane Austen, but Dickens has more energy.
To finish, some fun Apple reviews.
Right.
So one of them is a comment on Columbus.
Oh, look at this. Two stars.
Rationalizing slavery for Spanish something. Don't know what that says. And then the stupid remark about Harry and Meghan.
Oh, right.
They are standing up for themselves. You work for one of those dreadful gossip monger publications. That's you, Dominic.
This is clearly aimed at you again.
So, of course, you were obligated to slam two people who were trying to shed light on the trashy, inverted commas, royal family for shame. How do you plead to that?
Well, it's good to see that Meghan listens to the podcast.
They were on South Park, weren't they?
Yeah, they weren't they threatening to sue them?
So it's said. With what accuracy?
And then they were threatening to sue people who said they were threatening to sue them, or something like that.
Something like that. And now Harry's popped up and wants to be reincarnated as an elephant.
Does he?
Yeah.
But it's not a danger that he would shoot himself, because isn't he into...
No, his brother would shoot him.
Right.
Quick, William. Harry's been reincarnated as an elephant. Get your gun. No, that would be hard. That's unfair on William, because William's very keen on saving elephants.
He did a live stream. So he's taking a leaf from our book, Tom. He did a live stream with a therapist. Did you see this?
Yes. And he's very into drugs.
Yeah.
He's recommending drugs.
Did you see that he'd been trying to persuade the rest of his family to have therapy?
I did, yes.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall in the conversation where he was saying to Camilla, I really think you should...
Or the Queen.
Yes. Book a consultation.
What fun.
Oh, God. Right. You see, this will go down very badly with that reviewer.
Yeah.
Won't it?
Well, I doubt he's a member of the club, or she.
Yeah. So on that bombshell, thank you so much for listening. You've got your Ronald Reagan to listen to. Don't listen to it all at once. Then you've got Frankopan. And then after that, we will be back with Atlantis, two episodes on Atlantis. And we have loads of fun things to come after that. So goodbye.
Bye-bye.